figure is on the place of the PBL community in a shared future. And it's Professor Jim McCauley, University of Huddersfield, and followed by Joe Law of Great Marketing.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank the organisers for being back. With some other people, I went to see the Graham Mead play last night.
Jim, can you speak up?
Yeah, I went to see the Graham Mead play.
You go up and then drop down.
Just down on your order screen, Matt, Jim.
Last night, and as you know, Graham Mead, this is the latest in the Billy Fallen Moon trilogy. But in it, Graham Reed in the programme talks about his own background. I just want to read a bit of it out, if that's all right. The Reeds were burnt out, forced out of our dying in 1935. Apparently my father played the sash very loudly on a wind-up gramophone, his final act of defiance as they left the area. Yet he was never an Orangeman. He voted Labour all his life, and he cried when Joe Stalin died. It was maybe taken a little far.
That's a rumor.
My grandfather was a painter in the shipyard, worked on the Titanic. He signed the Covenant, was a member of the original UDF, and fought at the Somme. I find it hard to reconcile my image of that quiet little Christian gentleman with the horrors of the Somme. No problem with my other grandfather, a real tough man, one of five tough brothers. My mother often told me how they used to clear the pub. That neatly encapsulates a lot of the reference points that we've been talking about all day, just in one family story. Because one of the things I want to talk about very briefly is how the Loyalist community uses culture, how it sees its own culture, and a bit about how it uses memory. But I'm going to begin with a quotation from Desmond Bell, who identifies what he sees as the three major challenges facing the Loyalist working class. The first is economic, in particular the problems brought about through deindustrialisation and unemployment. The second is spatial, in particular those issues arising from the breakup of long-established working-class communities. And thirdly, political issues to be resolved around representation following the demise of unionism hegemony. All very valid, I'm sure you'll recognise, but the point probably worth making is Desmond made that statement in 1983. So I just want to also flag up that some of the issues we're talking about predate in many ways the peace process as well. And I suppose one of the questions we've been grappling with all day is what, if anything, has changed? And I guess quite a few people might well say very little. To the point where the newsletter editorial of the 10th of December 2008 asked the questions, are the Protestant working class out in the cold again? And while reviewing the aftermath of the 2011 assembly elections, Nick Garbutt said the following: large sections of working class loyalism have now become so socially disenfranchised and so politically alienated that they form what could be best described as the lost tribe of Northern Ireland. And just to end the first section, there was a very good history book by Thomas Bartlett, published last year or the year before. But he brings it, unusually for an historian, brings it right up to the contemporary period. And he says this, by way of the final summary of the book: there remains a very large loyalist underclass, poorly educated, mostly unskilled, socially disadvantaged, who harbour a belief that their position in Northern Ireland has drastically slipped and that their culture is no longer valued. While there is such a large reservoir of hatred, rancour and resentment, it is hard to feel optimistic. Equally, because the devolved structures were expressly designed to reflect and perpetuate sectarianism that was at the heart of the Northern Ireland state, it is only possible to feel a sort of nervous confidence where the future is concerned. And that's where I want to pick up. I want to pick up on the notion of nervous confidence? And in particular, is it possible for the Protestant Unionist Loyalist community to be positive about creating a shared future while being stuck in a position of nervous confidence? But I also just want to say a little about that community. I mean, we've been using the word community all day. When I was an undergraduate, I learned that, and that was a long time ago, that was in the early 1980s, 197 different uses of the word community in use in academic literature. I would dread to think of many that are. So I think I think it's also important to if we're talking about the Protestant Unionist Loyalist community, just to have some idea of what we mean by that. I suppose the first way to define the community is a group that define themselves on the basis of some shared identity. And I'm sorry, Roy, that Colin has left, because I respect a great deal of what he writes, but I entirely disagree with him that what's going on here is not about identity. This is a conflict deeply rooted in identity. Secondly, we've touched on this in different ways as well. A community is defined by others as well as by themselves. It's how others, both in the immediate society and more widely, define that community. And the loyalist community, thirdly, is often defined in terms of boundaries. Now, those can be territorial boundaries. And we've heard about painting the curbstones red, white, and blue in Sandy Road. But it can also be cultural boundaries, boundaries around language, around interest. And in particular, the stuff I'm trying to do some work on myself is narrative. I'm deeply interested in not just how the loyalist narrative is constructed, but how that narrative is passed on from generation to generation. I think when we are seeing protests in the street led by a banner that says we will not be the generation to feel Ulster, that is, there's something crucially important going on there, and I'll try and come back to that if I can. And the one thing we haven't also talked very much about community is community is deeply emotional. There's an emotional attachment to loyalism that is deeply under-researched and under-explored. Around things of connection, belonging, protection, recognition of things, shared cultural understandings, Britishness, whatever that means, religious bonds, heritage, national identity, Ulsterness, and so on. But the reason people define themselves as part of the loyalist community is answers questions for them. We should never forget that. People see themselves as loyalists because it's a way of giving a meaningful response to the world that's happening around them. And finally, there's another way of defining community. It comes from an academic author called Anthony Cohen, and he talks about community constructed through symbolism. And if we are going to talk about the flags dispute meaningfully, I think that's part of that understanding. So, it's important to try and move on from that, to think about how loyalism represents that sense of community. And too often, I think that representation is backward-looking and it's negative. Not that it's tyranny, I'm not saying that by any means that summarises loyalist culture, but it is a key dynamic within it. So I've been doing interviewing with loyalists lately. This is just a few examples. Loyalism represents a part of a community that's been constantly under threat for 400 years. While most members of the Protestant Unionist Loyalist community recognise that the shooting and the bombing war is over, we now see ourselves involved in a culture war that we must win. And that's actually been around, that whole notion of culture war has been around much longer than I think some people would realise. This is from the Orange Standard of 2007. It says, "The battle for the hearts and minds of the people will be fought with greater intensity than ever. Let no one be under any illusions. The campaign by Republicans and nationalists to erode British identity of Northern Ireland will be stepped up in many ways. the Orange Order and all of this will need to be in the vanguard of resistance to this phase and a strategy of Republican Nationalist Alliance to try and achieve their objectives. And much of that sense of community, much of that sense of being a community under siege, much of that sense of identity, much of that sense of culture war goes back to the way that political memories are produced and reproduced within liberalism. We touched on this this morning. I find it very interesting this morning. What we're not talking about here is history. Austerloyalism isn't about creating a history of Austerloyalism, whatever that would be. It's not about creating a true record of events. Rather, it's about constructing a past that can be used around politics at the present. So put very crudely, why are we more interested, or why is the Loyalist community more interested in Graham Reed's grandfather, who worked in the shipyard on the Titanic and fought the Salon in the original UDF, than they are in his father, who was a Labour voting Belfast Stalinist transline. I don't think we're going to get a chance to answer that, but that's important. It's also important when
2 minutes.
It's also important when it's used in the way it is. That sense of identity is used to guide reactions to contemporary political events. Past events and collective memories are used as metaphors. They're used as lessons to react in the present. And when people are looking for a way to react to political events of the present, what they do is they fall back on community narratives and community stories. We've already identified pretty clearly today the dominant basis of those community stories. So I just want to say, finally, in some sort of conclusion, what I'm not saying, because I've got myself in trouble in the past, I'm not saying that the Loyalist community culture is invalid. I'm not saying that it's somehow inept, even though it's less valid than others. I'm certainly not saying that Loyalist culture is to blame, because others in our society have constructed community identities and community cultures, and community memories are equally ring-fenced and equally explosive. I am saying that the dominant dynamic behind Loyalism continues to be predominantly defensive, and that Loyalist culture is seen largely or mainly only as a way of engaging the enemy by any other means. There are serious issues to be addressed, and that culture wars and shared futures make very uneasy bedfellows.